Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen, take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. About credit cards, credit card debt will soon be all of society's problem, according to Jay Evanson of the Deseret News. We finally have an answer to that chicken and egg question about credit card debt. You know the one. It was all the rage 3 years ago when Congress was debating bankruptcy reform. It is, have Americans gone hog wild with credit cards because credit card companies have been too aggressive and freewheeling in wooing consumers? Or do Americans have nobody to blame but themselves for their own behavior? I always leaned towards personal responsibility in that debate, although credit card companies who once sent my daughter tempting offers when she was 11 never seemed to be wearing white hats either. But it turns out that the answer is, that's a stupid question. Society as a whole is responsible, at least we're going to be. Now that the Christmas season is officially here, and many Americans have holstered their credit cards and begun contemplating what sort of meaningful gifts they might be able to sew, macrame, or duct tape together for their loved ones, you sort of knew it had to come to this. By some estimates, Americans shoulder about $900 billion in credit card debt. But two-thirds of the economy is tied to consumer spending. The day after Thanksgiving traditionally is called Black Friday, because that is the day in which retailers begin to see healthy profits, putting them in the black for the year. But this year, everyone seems to be bracing for a red Christmas. So the government is doing its darndest to get people to spend again. Last time the nation entered this type of spending downturn was in 2001, right after the attacks of 9/11. That was when President George W. Bush urged Americans to carry on as if nothing had happened. Go to Disney World, he said. Enjoy life. Spend. It's significant to note that no one in authority is saying that today, but that still seems to be the official national policy. Last week, the administration began talking about an additional $800 billion in new programs designed to jumpstart the economy. Significantly, a portion of this would go toward helping credit card companies. As the Associated Press reported, since September, when credit markets first froze, financial institutions have been hesitant to hand over money for fear they won't be repaid. That, in turn, had made it harder for businesses and consumers to borrow. In other words, the president may not be telling Americans to go out and spend as usual, but all the government's efforts seem to be focused on getting people back to that point, no matter how unwise it might be. Now, the British are taking a little different approach. The government there is on the verge of punishing credit card companies, telling them they need to allow borrowers to delay payment or reduce interest rates, otherwise they may be investigated, fined, or have their licenses revoked. But of course, credit card companies are charging high interest rates, in part because it is riskier than usual to lend money in the current economy. That is a logical market response. Here is another. Bad financial behavior will eventually be punished, often harshly. The market doesn't monkey around with heart-to-heart talks or group sessions to deal with personal issues. If you borrow more than you can afford, there will be a day of reckoning. And if the government insists on finding ways to delay that day, it will succeed only in spreading the misery. During better times, Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan once lauded the borrowing by low-income Americans as a sign of progress. Once, only the affluent could get credit. In the modern world, credit has been democratized. But just because the poor can eat as well as the rich doesn't mean that gluttony has suddenly become a healthy thing. I prefer Benjamin Franklin's policy, which was, better to go to bed supperless than to wake up in debt. As for that chicken and egg question, make mine scrambled. So again, that was by Jay Evenson of the Deseret News. And another article from Reuters by Martha Grabo, angry Citi investors to unveil new court complaint. After Citigroup Inc. shares tumbled last year on the bank's subprime mortgage woes, angry investors sued for fraud. Now stockholders are due to file a new version of their lawsuit as their losses have become much more stark. A lot has changed for the worse for Citigroup stockholders since the lawsuit about its subprime debt exposure was first brought in November 2007. The bank's shares are trading at around $6 apiece compared with $31 a year ago, even after two government bailouts in the last 2 months. The U.S. government this week agreed to inject $20 billion of capital and shoulder nearly $250 billion in potential losses on about $306 billion of the bank's risky assets after injecting $25 billion of taxpayer money in October. A consolidated shareholder complaint in the case is scheduled to be filed in the U.S. District Court in Manhattan. An earlier version accused Citigroup and several individuals, including former CEO Charles Prince, of violating securities law by artificially boosting the bank's stock price by concealing its exposure to subprime-linked debt. Citigroup believes the lawsuit is without merit and will defend against it vigorously, company spokesman Mike Hanretta said last week. The lawsuit, which seeks class action status on behalf of a large group of its stockholders, could be among the biggest subprime-related cases moving through U.S. courts, giving Citigroup's huge market declines. The company was once the biggest U.S. financial institution based on stock market value, but shares have plummeted and are down 54% this month alone. Shareholder lawsuits can take years to litigate. Many are ultimately thrown out by courts or settled. The lead plaintiff is a group of former employees and directors at closely held Automated Trading Desk, ATD, who received Citigroup stock in exchange for selling their electronic trading firm to the bank in a $680 million deal announced in July 2007. Through that deal, group members acquired more than 3.7 million Citigroup shares, which were valued at about $52 apiece at the time the buyout was being negotiated, according to a January court filing from the ATD plaintiffs. The group said its members have suffered losses of about $76.8 million as of January, a figure that is much higher now given Citigroup's stock declines this year. A lawyer for the shareholders, Ira Press, of the law firm Kirby McInerney LLP in New York, declined to comment about the specifics of the new court complaint, saying it is still being drafted. If last week is any indication, the story may still be unfolding, he said. We are obviously continuously monitoring the unfolding events. The original lawsuit was filed by an individual investor. Often shareholders have competed to become the lead plaintiff, a role that allows investors to help set strategy in the litigation and play a role in any possible settlement talks. U.S. District Judge Sidney Stein, who is overseeing the case, appointed the ATD Group as the lead plaintiff in August. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. At the onset of the second session of the show, I'd like to start with an important credit, because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's very great champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and the Two Income Trap. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com. Look in archives for Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows from the past in this program. And that would be very useful for helping you to understand everything that you need to in dealing with your debt. Now I'd like to move on to the second portion of our show. I'm going to recap some of the ideas that I shared with you last week. We're talking about making a lifetime savings plan. We had four stages to that plan. Over the last couple of weeks, I've discussed those stages. Stage one, saving $1,000 as your basic mini emergency fund and basically your fund to prevent you from having to use credit cards or get socked with paying for bounced checks or late fees or to have to wait for your paycheck to clear before you pay a bill and those kinds of things. So it's a cushion. It's a safety cushion. The second stage was to pay off your steal from tomorrow debt. And that's really taking this 20% savings I've been talking about and paying off all of your non-bare necessity debt. In other words, mostly your unsecured debt that has been eating at you for years. And it's a very important thing to do to get you into a position where you can save to actually create some wealth for your future. The third stage I discussed was to build a six-month security fund. And this is to take your bare necessities, which is 50% of your net monthly income. So we've calculated this amount, and you have a plan, and you take that amount of money. Now, once you have your $1,000 saved, and you have paid off your debt using the plans and formulas that we have gone through in this program, and you have a creation of a fund that is for big emergencies, and this big emergency fund is six times the amount of your bare necessities allocation. So if you have $3,000 a month in disposable net income, one half of that, 50%, is $1,500. You would need to take six times that, which is $9,000, and put that aside in an ordinary savings account in case you lose your job, some tragedy happens, there's something big that comes down in your life, that you can live at the bare necessities level for the next 6 months for your shelter, your food, and your transportation for work-related issues. And that security fund is very, very critical in dealing with real problems in your life. And also last week, we commenced stage four, which is a lifetime wealth creation stage of savings. And this stage is very, very much the place we want to be. It has three subparts to it. We save for retirement, we save to pay off our house mortgage, and we save for our other dreams. And as a recap from last week, we looked at first component, which is creation of a retirement fund, saving for your golden years, and you can put money so you can have some down line. And we discuss why saving for retirement is important, not just for people who are near retirement, but for everyone, even if it looks so far away and there are many things that you need or want right now. And have discussed that you may love your job and never want to retire, and you plan to strike it rich somehow, someday, win the lottery, get an inheritance. There's no need to save for old age. And maybe have that mythical immortality notion that you are going to stay forever young, and so you don't have to think about retirement. But that's not a good plan. We need to be practical, have our feet on the ground, and start as young as possible to put some money aside. And we needed to note, and it's an important principle, that the government gives out a pile of tax breaks to help you save for retirement, and that in fact a little savings does go a long way. So in other words, it's easy and you just need to do it. One thing we reviewed were some scary statistics. What I said was that 1 in 8 older Americans lives in poverty. Point two is that the average Social Security payment is only about $10,000 a year. not even enough to live in safety and in many places, let alone in comfort. Number three is that the elderly are now the fastest growing group that is falling into bankruptcy. And then, as the economists are looking at the nature of what's going on in our economy, they are predicting today's workers will be a whopping $45 billion short of what they really need to live on when they retire. Of course, those are the scary concepts, the scary ideas, but there is a possibility to be financially prepared and be ready for your retirement. The objective is that when the time comes, you can retire in both comfort and dignity. You will be able to cover your basic needs, money for your care, money to let you pay your own way. You no longer need to hope for charity from others, and you no longer need to have the idea that you're going to be forced to work longer than you are physically able. So you have prepared your way. You've taken control of your life. And finally, what we said last week is that you should sign up for a retirement plan at work. Many, many good businesses do have retirement plans. The boss has already done all of the footwork for you by getting the plan set up. You get automatic tax breaks from it. Your company may also give you matching contributions, which you should ask about. That is really free money lying on the ground. You just have to go and take it. And then, of course, if you're self-employed or your company does not have a retirement plan, you can create your own retirement plan, an IRA, an individual retirement account. You can get a SEP IRA or an individual 401k. These offer higher limits and extra tax breaks to small business owners, but IRAs are very easy to set up. You go to your local bank or online through financial institutions and look for IRAs that have low fees and plenty of investment opportunities. And then once you open your account, you can just start contributing. The IRA will be a fund that helps you to reduce your taxes, so you can take advantage of that. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. We were just talking about retirement savings, and now there are some myths about retirement savings that I'd like to discuss. The first myth is you can count on Social Security to see you through old age. If you've been listening to this show or keeping up other places in the news, we know that Social Security benefits are not enough to live on. And in fact, it's a very shaky system right now that is funded by money that may not be there in the future. Number two, you don't need to save for retirement if you plan to keep working. And the fact is, you need to be prepared in case you are not able to keep working. As people do get older, the things come up unexpectedly, and frankly, some jobs, with the way the economy is turning and twisting, are asking people, even if you're well positioned in the company, to leave earlier side of retirement because you costs more than the company wants to afford. So you really should think about that from all different angles. Another point, which is mythical, is that you can wait to start saving until the kids are grown. I know many families are just trying to use their money for their kids, for braces and all the kinds of things that kids want and need. But the fact is, the earlier you start building a retirement fund, the bigger your financial rewards will be. Another point, which is mythical, and that is if you keep working and don't retire, your retirement savings will be wasted. Well, the fact is, the money is yours, no matter what, it belongs to you. If you don't need it for retirement, you can pass it on to your kids, use it for an emergency, or buy something nice with it. And then, as I said earlier, if you don't put too much attention on getting old and think about it, you will stay young. Now, of course, I am a very firm proponent of diet, exercise, and daily routine, being healthy, eating properly, getting your exercise as much as possible. Those are great things to help you keep young. But the fact is that you will get old, and you will have to eventually retire. So it is a mythical thought to think that you're going to stay young and never have a retirement phase in your life or need the money for that phase. And while we're talking about retirement, you can go to the library. There have been entire books written on retirement planning. So if you want to learn more, there's plenty of information out there. AARP is a very good place to start. And of course, you could always review what I just said in this show, which basically boils down all of the issues to two simple things. Sign up for your retirement plan at work, or if they don't have one, create your own retirement plan, your IRA. So the last question is, with respect to retirement accounts, is how much should you put in your retirement account? Now, we're talking about 20% savings. You've already set up all of your first stage $1,000 savings. You have paid off your debt through stage two, and you have your security fund in stage three, and you have a few subsection areas in stage four where we're at for savings. But this 20% should be divided, and it should be in the neighborhood of about 10% of your take-home pay for your retirement account. If your employer contributes to your pension, you can put in less than 10% because that will be covered somewhat by your employer. One thing to realize, that if you're just starting this program and you're over 35 and you're just starting to do a retirement plan at that age, now you should probably put in a little bit more, and this will give you a good footing for a comfortable retirement, and you will leave plenty to pay off your home and your other dreams that we will talk about. Having a retirement plan and putting money into it, you will be in a really exclusive class of Americans, because nearly half of all Americans never make it this far. So you will be in the upper half of the financially well-adjusted adults in America if you get this plan together. Now that we've dealt with the retirement, let's go over to paying off your home. Just imagine for a second owning the home completely outright, 100% paid, free and clear, no more mortgage payments every month, no rent checks. That would be unbelievable. And it is a tremendously smart financial move to start paying off that mortgage with your savings, and it would be extraordinarily satisfying. You get a great return on your money by doing this because of all the interest that you're saving, and also the fact that you are directly increasing the equity in your home. This is a great part of your retirement plan. So when you stop working, you can live rent-free, and that means that your Social Security and retirement savings will actually go a lot further. And if you later on need cash, you can sell your house, move to something smaller. But if not, you also have a wonderful legacy which you can pass along to your children or to some charity, whatever you desire. Paying off your home gives you a lot of freedom, and it makes you have a lot more cash available for you, so you have money to spend on anything you want, more fun, more freedom to give. You actually could work a lot less and play a whole lot more if you don't have that mortgage payment. But what about mortgage tax credits? A lot of people think that this is such a critical reason to own a home and be paying a mortgage. Well, there is really no tax credit that is worth prolonging your mortgage payments. Let's just give an example. Let's suppose you're paying $1,000 a month for your mortgage, and you're at that part of your amortization that you are paying $700 towards interest and $300 to principal. So when you look at that and you look at the tax ramifications, you will be saving somewhere around $200 on your taxes. Now, you want to keep paying $1,000 to the bank so you can save $200? Well, obviously and logically, this is not wise. The reality is that tax credits, in a way, are, as Professor Warren says, like paper towels. You have to spill your own milk, make the payments before the tax credit
helps you sop up some of it back. So it's not really the reason why you want to be paying your mortgage at all. Now, what if you plan to sell your house in the near future? If you are selling your house, you are walking away with equity, and the equity increases for every dollar you pay down on the mortgage. And whether you take that mortgage money that is now in your equity and put it into another home or just put it in your pocket, you are getting a great advantage by reducing the amount of your mortgage and increasing the amount of equity that you have. Well, another question comes up. Doesn't it make sense to borrow against the equity in your home when interest rates are low? Well, all you have to do is read what's going on in the newspapers these days, and you will see that all of these exotic mortgages started out with low interest rates. In fact, many of the mortgages, a vast majority of the mortgages that have gone belly up in this market, were for refinancing. And people were thinking, oh, I could take that money and I can pay off credit cards, I could take a vacation, I can pay for my child's college. But in all these cases, and I have a number of cases like this, that this is borrowing, and it's actually borrowing against your most important asset. It's not saving, it's not smart, it's not savvy, and these markets tend to burst in terms of what they are offering, and many people have lost their shirts and their homes because of such thinking. In our plan, a second mortgage or HELOC, a home equity line of credit, is really taking away from tomorrow by creating debt, with the added twist that if something does go wrong, and you can see, as I said, in the marketplace that many things have gone wrong and you can't pay, the mortgage lender can take your house away. And this is extraordinarily devastating for people. It's much better to just pay down your mortgage and have that contented debt-free status. Now, what about those of you who don't own a home? This is not an advice to just go out and buy one. If you don't own a home, it may make sense to buy one, or it may not. And later on, we're going to look at whether or not home ownership is appropriate for you. But for now, buying a home is not the right choice for some people, and renting is perfectly fine. And if that's what you're doing, until we get to that other lesson, we will just presume that not having the home is fine. Renters still need to keep saving. You take your money and put that 20% into retirement and other savings, which we'll discuss next week, your dream savings. And if a home doesn't make sense for you and you are saving the 20%, you will be doing just fine. So that's also a very good situation to be in if it is appropriate. And then finally, how do you pay off your home with the savings? Well, you just do it like everything else I have discussed, $1 at a time. Out of the 20%, 10% went to retirement. Now you take 5% of your income out of the 20% and use it to pay on your mortgage principal, extra mortgage pay down of the principal every month. And that will be a great surprise, again, depending on where you are in the amortization period. At the beginning, it's better. In the middle, it's good. And towards the end, it may not be as great, but you're still going to be saving. And if you do it quickly and you do it early in your amortization, you will really cut back tremendously on the number of years that you'll have to pay that mortgage, because you will reduce the overall amount of payment that you have to pay for interest, and it would save you extraordinary amounts of interest. So that's part two, paying off your home. Next week, we'll look at saving for your other dreams. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from through LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.